KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, it's the best of The Business as we put Hollywood on the couch with writer-turned-therapist Dennis Palumbo. Go nowhere, it's The Business from NPR. Dennis Palumbo worked as a screenwriter in Hollywood for 15 years, with feature film credits like My Favorite Year and TV shows like Welcome Back, Kotter. But like so many writers, he was also in therapy, and at some point realized he liked the process of therapy better than the business of show business. He went back to school, and in the nearly two decades since, he's been treating Hollywood creative types for their very special brand of neurosis. With everything that's been going on in Hollywood lately, we thought it would be a good idea to head back to the couch with Dennis Palumbo. The business host Claude Brodesser-Ackner spoke with him last May.
Welcome to The Business.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You say that it's the same everywhere, therapy.
Yes.
Except here.
Here, where it's different.
Where it's different. What do you mean?
What I mean is that the issues that I see with my patients, you know, anxiety, depression, relationship issues, are the same as everyone else has. Except for the fact that in the Hollywood community, first of all, for a creative person, these issues are tremendously important because if you're a writer or a director or an actor, you're so affected by this material. You can be having an argument with your wife, and if you're a bricklayer, you can still lay bricks. But if you're a screenwriter or an actor, the raw materials of your work is your personal life. And so it's really wrapped up in it. And secondly, this is a public arena if you're an actor or a writer or a director. So the pressure of the spotlight enhances all of your career issues. You know, if you're a lawyer and you don't have as many cases this year as you did last year, that's one thing. If you're a TV writer and you're not on a show this year and you were on one last year, everyone in Hollywood knows it. And so there's a kind of public exposure to all the same pressures everyone else has in terms of occupation and relationships, but the prism can be very public and the stakes can be very big.
I think there is a widespread conception, maybe misconception, mm-hmm. that writers are the most miserable people. That, you know, directors are all autocrats, writers are all misanthropes, and actors are all narcissists. Are the cliches true?
Well, in a certain way they are, but only really, really broadly. I mean, a writer friend of mine once described writers as egomaniacs with low self-esteem. And that's a pretty good description. I think on the whole, particularly in Hollywood and particularly in screenwriting, screenwriters are probably the most frustrated and angry because they have the least control compared to how important their contribution is.
What's the single biggest issue with writers?
Okay, the biggest single issue I would say probably is fear of failure, mm-hmm. a concern that if they don't succeed, their fears and doubts about how talented they are will be confirmed. You know, it's funny. Everyone makes fun of Sally Field when she got up and got her Oscar and said, "You like me. You really like me." But I thought it was the only honest Oscar acceptance speech I'd ever heard because most people, particularly writers, but most people who come to Hollywood are in search of an approving parent. And it's the worst place in the world to find one. And I think that's why writers in particular turn their agents or their managers or the studio or their producers into parent figures. And their writing is a way to get approval.
Is that why we see so many people choke after winning an Oscar? That is, having finally gotten that success, it's supposed to scratch the itch, and it doesn't? Is that it?
Well, I think
so. Why do so many people succeed at the highest level and then...
Well, I think there's a couple things. It's, first of all, I think the smart writer... The smart creative person understands that awards are nice, And that kind of validation is nice. But the next day, you still have to sit at the keyboard and sweat. There is no place you get to where you're done.
Except in Hollywood, that it's not really the case. I mean, James Cameron won the Oscar for Titanic.
Right.
And he never made well, I mean, he's making a movie now, mm-hmm. finally, but at Fox. But 10 years went by.
Well, it's true. There's a number of reasons that happens. Number one, once you've won an Oscar, in my experience, in my practice with both writers and directors, once you've won an Oscar, there's a tremendous pressure that your next project be great. And so you'll often spend a year or two developing a script or a project and go, nope, this isn't great enough. And then you'll do another one. Conversely, a lot of my Oscar-winning screenwriter patients, after winning the Oscar, the very next job they have, the producer or studio invariably is disappointed with the script they hand in. Sort of like, oh, he got an Oscar last year, but this one doesn't seem Oscar caliber to us. The expectation game, the bar gets raised so high that you begin to fear that the worst thing that ever happened to you was winning the Oscar. I had a number of patients in my practice who told me that being nominated was great, but winning was a curse. So that the expectations were you were an Oscar-nominated writer or director, but you weren't under any obligation to deliver the goods at that same level again.
It's interesting because I hear that a lot from executives on the other side,
mm-hmm.
the business side. The best job they ever had was executive vice president.
That's right.
They had all the power. They had all the prestige, or most of it. But without being the chief, without having the head on the chopping block on every single decision, that once you rescind to the throne, you know.
Yeah, there's only one place to go, you know, it is down. And so I think that's why for many, many creative people, the process of the journey is better than the reward that they think will make them feel so good. I mean, what I often tell my writers is enjoy the process of writing, the day-to-dayness of being a writer. Because those peaks, when they come, will not answer those deep psychological yearnings that you have. It's only growing in a kind of sense of craft and mastery that makes you feel really good as a creative person.
Directors, what is the biggest issue with these guys?
Oh, the biggest issue with directors is simple, is their vision going to be realized? Everything they make, they feel, is going to be looked at by all the film critics of the world and put in a kind of list, in a hierarchy. You know, so Orson Welles and Truffaut and Kurosawa is up here. And then down here is the guy that made, you know, Hey Dude, Where's My Car? And every director wants to be Stanley Kubrick and Orson Welles. They really want to aim for the bleachers, like every baseball player wants to be Babe Ruth.
But it almost sounds like that sets you up for another kind of problem as a director, which is you're talking about in the entire pantheon of film, those are 5, 6, 7, maybe
mm-hmm.
two hands. You can count those directors' names.
I know. I can't tell you how often I've had a filmmaker in my practice who struggled to get the script right, struggled to get the kind of cast that he wants, struggled with the changes and edits that the studio has done, and it's sort of like trying to hold on to your baby as long as possible. And then when it finally comes out into the world, you feel as though it's not exactly the baby that I raised. And you can go two ways with that. You can understand this is the business and I have only as much control as I have. Or you can do what a lot of my patients do, my director patients, which is go, well, I'm no Billy Wilder. Who was I kidding?
Or you could drink.
Or you could drink or use drugs, which is a huge issue in my practice. So I think the expectation on a director to know everything and to be the captain of the ship is very, very, very crushing. On the opposite side, and this is where writers will probably go, well, the heck with them. Who cares about them? Directors are credited in a huge way with the success of a film. But there's so many elements that go into why a film like Iron Man would do as well as it did that to just focus on the director as the reason it happened isn't really logical. So the director's problems, I think, is they are both overly validated when the film or TV show, the film rather, is a hit, and they are overly crushed and blamed when the film isn't.
You had an interesting slip of the tongue mm-hmm. just now where you almost said, you know, that the TV show, and then you realized, I think, as we both do, that television directors can make a fine living,
yes.
can live in a nice home, but get about as much respect as elevator operators.
Yeah, they're essentially considered craftsmen and craftswomen for hire. And it's very in television, a lot – when people ask me, gee, you know, are writers happy? I go, well, the least happy writers are screenwriters, and the happiest writers are TV writers, because in television, they are the boss.
If you're just joining us, Claude Brodesser-Ackner is speaking with Hollywood writer-turned-Hollywood therapist Dennis Palumbo.
Let's talk about actors.
Sure.
What do you think the biggest issue is with actors?
Well, it's stereotypical, I'm afraid, but it's true. There's a crippling insecurity.
I'm astonished.
I know. But it is the truth that for most actors, in my experience, there's a huge deficit in self-regard and self-love. And that they're often shy and often really insecure about their ability to do other things. Most of the actors in my practice, even the most successful ones, always feel that at some point somebody's going to come in and tap them on the shoulder and said, oh my gosh, there's been a terrible mistake. You're not a movie star. There's been a terrible mistake. You've been found out. I think –
And the lack of confidence leaves them uniquely positioned for a life of misery because they can never leave this business.
That's right. And the other thing is the success, the level of focus, you know, where paparazzi are following you around and, you know, people are just always want to be in your entourage and stuff, constantly reinforces you're important, you're great, you're special. And the actor's struggle is to sort of not buy into it such that the crash will be so big if their movie bombs or their series dies or their career takes a dip.
This leads to the obvious question, which mm-hmm. is, are these people sick before they even set foot in Hollywood, or are they made sick or sicker by Hollywood when they finally get to you?
Well, I would probably never use a phrase like sick because I don't find
– off.
No, I don't agree. Actually, in my experience before – I mean, I've worked with many different types of people, and I would say there is no actor that is more narcissistic than the head of a law firm or the CEO of a major multinational corporation. It's just that the narcissism is displayed in a different kind of way, in a public kind of way. In Hollywood, most of the people who come to Hollywood, regardless of their aesthetic ambition, most of the time, and this is a huge generality, they are aspiring to a level of success larger than your average person's. So the risk factor is higher, and the regular normal anxiety and insecurity is exacerbated. In other words, a young woman going to get a job as a secretary in a law firm in Dayton, Ohio, is going to be anxious at her job interview. A woman going to audition for a TV series that will either make her a working actor or cause her to have to go back and work at Jack in the Box and have her agent go, well, I guess if you can't get a job, I'm not sending you out on any more auditions. The level of anxiety is different because the stakes are so high and the personal meaning for both of them is so different. The young woman who doesn't get the job as a secretary might walk away feeling, God, you know, I'm really And then her parent or loved one goes, try a different place. And then she does. But in Hollywood, when people fail, all their friends and relatives go, look, this business is too tough. You know, the odds are really against you. You're crazy to want to do this anyway. So you not only have to deal with your own insecurities and doubts and sort of get yourself up the next morning for the next job interview, you have to do it withstanding the criticism and doubt of almost everyone in your environment. So I think it's a little unfair to say about people in Hollywood, well, you're more messed up than others. I worked with a group of lawyers one time. I did a therapy group with attorneys. They were about as depressed, anxious, and using substance as any creative people I'd ever worked with.
You said a little while back that, especially with actors, but with a lot of people in the creative field, that the fear is there'll be a knock at the door, a tap on the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
We regret to inform you that you are an enormous fraud.
Yes.
What's that about?
I think it's because from a very young age, when a person says, gee, I'd like to be a writer, I'd like to be an actor or whatever, it seems so grandiose. It seems so elevated. I mean, if you watch Will Smith on screen and you're a kid who says, you know, gee, I want to be a movie star just like him, your fantasy is he or she has something you don't have. You're not enough. I think one of the reasons that people, you know, read self-help books and stuff is that they have this idea that there's a perfectible version of themselves in the future, and that person will be happy and successful and very secure. Most creative people, when they begin having some success, get a kind of validation, like they're on Oprah or the paparazzi follow them around or magazines interview them and want to know their position on the environment. But inside themselves, they know they're the same schmuck that, you know, grew up in some small town looking up at a movie screen wanting to be an actor. And so they see a disconnect between the public approbation and validation and their sense of themselves, which is that they're just this regular, insecure, neurotic slug. And so someone will find that out. The fear is that it will be found out that they are much less than we thought.
In Hollywood, though, it's possible to actually, though, be a fraud and be successful. And I'm not talking about the idea of, oh, I feel like a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can maybe have one fluke success mm-hmm. and dine out on it for mm-hmm. 10 years. You could set up project after project after project, not get any of them made.
Mm-hmm.
You could write script after script, sell them, but they never see the screen. There is a sense of you're not really – you may be in the guild. You may do these things. You may sell these projects, but you – it's like tantric sex almost. You never get to to the release of the picture.
And it's a lot more fun with tantric sex. I understand what you're saying. Again, I think of the word fraud. I think of someone who has a reward that's not commensurate with what he or she actually did. You have a fluke success, as you said. And I think those, you know, where someone dines out on one thing for 10 years – to me, that's just a function of the fact that life isn't fair. I think if you've written five screenplays and they've gotten to a certain level of development and they don't get made, it's not because you're a fraud. It's because the vagaries of the marketplace have changed.
But it's easy to see yourself that way.
It's easy to see yourself.
I live in a huge house. I drive an expensive car.
Right.
And I have done nothing.
Right. I have a number of screenwriter patients who have made very significant livings and live in a big house and have their kids in private school, and they haven't had a film made in 7 or 8 or 9 years. But they keep getting paid to write and develop screenplays. And you live in this kind of strange netherworld where we're always trying to explain to your relatives what it is you do for a living, because it's very hard for civilians to understand what development is. Most screenplays don't get made into movies. And yet many, many writers every year are paid to develop these screenplays because the studios need to pick and choose from the products available to them as to which films they're going to make. And writers have very little control. Even directors have very little control over that kind of a situation. I mean, look what happened last year or 2 years ago, I guess, at Disney, when suddenly they took their feature development slate that was going to be like 15 or 16 films and they said, no, let's make them 8. They wanted them all to be franchise films like Pirates of the Caribbean. Well, the people whose – the 4 or 5 or 6 films that were in development up until that moment were suddenly not going to get made, not because the makers of those projects were frauds, but because Disney made a business decision that had nothing to do with them.
Not every film can make $1 billion worldwide.
Right. That's right.
Coming up after a short break, more with Hollywood therapist Dennis Palumbo. You're listening to The Business from NPR.
Mama hates show business. Said it ain't no business to get involved in.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Matt Holzman. Hollywood is the town that put the fun back in dysfunctional. As the writer of feature films like My Favorite Year and TV shows like Welcome Back, Kotter, Dennis Palumbo would know. For years, he suffered the very special kind of stresses endured by Hollywood creative types, with the help of his therapist. Now, as a psychotherapist himself, he's uniquely qualified to let the healing begin for writers, directors, and actors who may seem fragile or neurotic or trifling or demanding, insecure. Well, you get the idea. The business host Claude Brodesser-Ackner spoke to Dennis Palumbo last May.
You mentioned some of the things that hamstring people, given mm-hmm. their given profession. Writers, the lack of control. Directors, the need to have a vision realized. Actors needing some sort of approbation that they may never find.
Validation,
even
even
in outrageous success. I'm wondering how those things inform people's inability to leave when the business is making them utterly miserable.
Well, that's the thing that's the paradox. You know, in behavioral psychology, there's something called intermittent reinforcement. And people who've been to Vegas know what that is. That's where you're pulling the one-arm bandit handle down 25 times and you're just about to stop. And then you see next door someone pulls it down and a bunch of coins come out. So you start pulling the handle again. And Hollywood is sort of like that. There's intermittent reinforcement in the sense that there's always the possibility that the very next phone call is your agent offering you a job, that the very next story you pitch, someone's going to buy. There's this great fear that if they leave the business, had they stayed a little bit longer, things would have paid off. And I think that's why it's so hard for people to leave the business. Secondly, I think many of my patients who have been struggling a lot will say, there's nothing else I want or that would feel as good to me or, frankly, that I'm qualified to do.
This is a business where it's very hard to point to a concrete, definite answer of this is why it was a success. That has to be unnerving on a grand scale for people.
Oh, it is. There's not a concrete thing you can do. In other words, if you're saying to someone, I'm going to sell you some pasture land here in Florida, and you go there and there's no pasture land, you go, well, there's a fact. That's fraud. There's no pasture land. Hollywood is a place where, as William Goldman says, nobody knows anything. And because of that, people get so crazy because there's nothing that they can hold on to. That's a recipe for anxiety.
Everyone wants to be known as an artist in Hollywood. And they're making all this money. They're on a show. It's kind of a stupid sitcom. Does that disconnect between the value of what they're creating and the value of what they're paid, does that create a conflict?
Oh, yeah. It creates a huge amount of conflict because most aspiring writers and actors and directors have very lofty ambitions for themselves because the models they read and watched and wanted to emulate growing up are usually hugely successful artistically. And if you're someone who grew up watching Billy Wilder films or Preston Sturges films or Stanley Kubrick films and your job is directing, you know, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure Part 7, you feel an enormous disconnect between the fact that you're getting paid $1 million and you have no respect for what you do and that the people around you have no respect for what you do either unless it makes money. Then they'll say to you, what do you care as long as you're making a lot of money? So most creative people walk around with that conflict inside. Who am I to complain? And at the same time thinking, this isn't exactly what I thought I was going to be doing.
You know, given the ubiquity of this misery, you would think that it would produce a certain amount of widespread compassion. But it seems like the opposite is the case. It seems like there is a tremendous amount of schadenfreude of, at least it's not me.
Mm-hmm. I think the reason there's so much envy is because it's such a competitive marketplace, and we believe that if person A has success, that's a success I'm not going to have. My experience with envy in myself and in my patients is it's usually a signal to you of how important the thing is you want to do. I've never had a patient who was very happy with what they were writing or very excited about a film they were directing that had much envy. And that's why one of the things that I advise patients all the time is to look for solace and gratification in the work that they're doing. I think the process of work saves your butt because if you're only excited when your screenplay gets made into a film that's released, that's going to happen once every 5 or 7 years. And when they do come, your dissatisfaction that they don't make you feel as good as you thought will just disconfirm the value of doing all the work. Will you be jealous and envious of other people's success? Yes.
Do you have access to specific deal information that could be used for, you know, untoward, nefarious purposes? I mean, you know, have you ever been approached by people saying, you know, what's he thinking? What is he thinking? We need to divine his innermost thoughts. What's he thinking? Can you help us?
Once or twice I've gotten a phone call like that because I am privy.
Tell me about the phone call.
Okay, I have to couch this carefully. A studio wanted to make a deal with one of my patients. Another studio wanted to make a deal with that same person. An executive from Studio A called me and said, I happen to know because this is unbelievable. The patient's agent told me that he was seeing you. And I wanted to know because my patient made the mistake of telling his agent he was seeing me. And he said, what's his thinking? Which way is he leaning? And I, of course, said, I can't even acknowledge I know who you're talking about. And I hung up the phone. There is no end to what managers, producers, high-ranking agents, and studio executives will do. It's a down-and-dirty business. It really is.
Lesson here, don't tell your agent anything.
Yeah, I would certainly not. But you'd be surprised how many of my patients tell their agents that they see me.
Do the travesties and travails of your clients help you avoid missing the business when they tell you about their triumphs?
Yes. I enjoy their triumphs a lot because usually I've been part of the struggle that has gotten them there. When a showrunner has had, you know, 7 pilots in 7 pilot seasons not get on the air, by the time the 8th one finally does, we want to break out the champagne.
Assuming he's not an AA.
Yeah, assuming he's not an AA. And that's, of course, metaphorical. There's no actual champagne in my office. Yeah. You should know.
The term Hollywood ending exists for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
I would think that, and I'd ask you this question, does having to write these Hollywood endings all the time sort of ultimately unnerve people when they don't get that Hollywood ending in their own life?
All the time. One of my patients is a woman who writes very successful romantic comedies. You've seen them. And her marriage and personal life is a disaster. And she used to say to me, I write fairy tales. I don't believe in them. And that is a real issue in that movies have always, and television shows to some extent, have always presented a kind of idealized world because narrative structure requires an ending. Life doesn't work that way. And so as a result, after 10 or 15 years of writing movies or television, or even writing novels, because I have novelists as well in my practice, the reality that life is not as structured and organized and it doesn't pay off the way film and TV scenes do is very unnerving.
Dennis Palumbo was a Hollywood screenwriter who is now a licensed psychotherapist in private practice in Los Angeles. He specializes in helping new and established screenwriters, directors, and novelists address creative issues, as well as those involving midlife and career transition. He's also the author of a book of whodunit stories, From Crime to Crime, Mind-Boggling Tales of Mystery and Murder. And that's The Business. I'm Matt Holzman, and I produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can podcast The Business, share with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button from our new media player at kcrw.com, or you can podcast the show from iTunes. Our email is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Matt Holzman. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.